tell you, but you know you can't mess with my mind.
Welcome to Economics and Beyond. I'm Rob Johnson, president of the Institute for New Economic Thinking.
But you know you can't mess with my mind.
So you can't kill my mind.
You know we'll go away.
We're gonna go away.
Come back, come back, come back,
come back.
My second time.
I'm here today again with Jayati Ghosh, and here to talk about the pandemic, the implications for sovereign debt, and the potential of sovereign debt restructuring, or the necessity of sovereign debt restructuring, as many people see, as this horrid episode is playing out deeper and much longer than we had expected. Jayati, thanks for rejoining me.
It's a pleasure, Rob.
So here we are, almost time for Santa Claus. I know you have moved to the University of Massachusetts at Amherst in the Political Economy Research Institute. Our good friends like Bob Pollan and many others are located there. But I know you, regardless of where your desk is, your perspective will always be global, and particularly as it pertains to the Global South. What is it that you see at this juncture with regard to the accumulation of pressure in the downturn, its relation to sovereign debt, and the, what you might call the different pathways that we might, through struggle, either healthy or unhealthy, pursue as this unfolds?
I think this period of the pandemic has brought about even greater inequality than we could have imagined at the beginning of this year. And this inequality has been expressed globally in so many different ways, not just in terms of how the disease has played out or the access to public health or any of those things, but also in terms of how the global economy has affected different groups of countries. And what's been particularly sharp in many countries of the South, and I'm going to leave out China and East Asia, which are exceptional here. So everything I say doesn't apply to China and East Asia. But everywhere else, there's been this dramatic increase in vulnerability and fragility, a lot of which is really not of their own making. But of course, it's also true that, you know, we had this explosion of debt, both private and public debt, in the developing world before the pandemic. So in fact, already public debt had gone up a little bit. On average, I think it had gone up to around half of GDP by the beginning of 2019. But private debt had really exploded. And the estimates for the developing world for private debt, external private debt, were about 83% of GDP to 140% of GDP. So it was really a very different thing. It wasn't any more purely sovereign debt. It was a lot of corporate debt and household debt, but borrowing by the private non-financial sector. And we know that this is a problem because ultimately it's still the government that gets left holding the baby when this debt becomes unpayable. There were many people who were saying even before the pandemic that some of this debt is actually unpayable. But it's happened very rapidly, and it was a combination of bond markets and other debt markets and so on. But then you had the pandemic, which actually meant a massive, massive change in the external circumstances of many developing countries. Dramatic decline in exports, which hasn't recovered really for most countries. Again, as I said, I'm leaving out East Asia and China. And a decline in other kinds of earnings like tourism, remittances of migrant workers abroad, etc. So you're losing access to a lot of foreign exchange. Your own domestic economies are ravaged because you're imposing lockdowns or you are having to deal with the effects of the disease playing out. So domestic economic activity is collapsing. And then you have to suddenly and continuously keep paying your debt payments. It's very extraordinary that in the advanced world, all kinds of measures were made to actually deal with this problem in the form of debt standstills in some countries, moratoria in other countries where you really didn't enforce the system. This didn't occur for most developing countries. Only a few highly indebted poor countries were given any kind of debt relief over this period. A very large group of developing countries, emerging markets, who also were facing extreme difficulty, did not get any kind of relief, which is quite extraordinary when you think that major multinational companies, airlines, you know, petrochemical companies, you name it, everybody's getting relief. But countries that are in extreme difficulty and facing exactly the same external circumstances, or rather worse external circumstances, they are not getting any of this relief.
And the interesting feature here is that historically, when debtors and creditors get to an unsustainable place, there's almost a moral righteousness on the part of the creditor that says the debtor messed things up or didn't do their job or what have you. But it's very hard to make an argument such as that in the context of a pandemic. To use a simple kind of leading example, Argentina did not create the pandemic, nor did India. And so the distribution of the stress is very, very, what you might call, a collective design. And relying on precedents from historic power struggles doesn't seem to contribute too much illumination to what needs to be done.
I think that's true. But what I find interesting is that there are two examples that are available to, shall we say, the global financial architecture and the arrangements. There are two examples, one historical and one current, which are available in terms of how you could actually address this problem of sovereign debt of developing countries, or even all external debt of developing countries. The historical example, of course, is that famous London Agreement, where Germany got a massive benefit in 1951. And of course, the context is very different. You've had the end of the Second World War. You have a Cold War emerging. You have a West, or rather, shall we say, the capitalist powers in general, and the United States in particular, anxious to see Germany become a viable proposition economically. And so you get, I would argue, one of the most generous and forward-looking debt settlements that we have experienced, whereby the creditors agree to take, to write off around half of the debt, and then agree to limit the debt servicing to 3% of the exports every year, and essentially enable Germany to grow out of this debt. It's quite extraordinary to see that these creditors, of course, include the United States and England and a whole bunch of other countries, but also Greece, which didn't get the same kind of generosity from Germany when it had its own debt problem quite recently. But this was, I would argue, one of the major reasons why Germany was able to emerge as an industrial power in that subsequent period from the 50s onwards, because it didn't have to deal with that huge backlog of debt. It was able to grow its way out of the remaining debt, and it was able to invest and to accumulate in a way that created the industrial powerhouse that we've seen.
I was just going to say, I just wanted to interject something here that just flew into my imagination. Perhaps Germany was the beneficiary of being in such close proximity to the USSR. What I mean by that is, I'll use a generic term, the fear of regime switching towards communism led the West to want to keep Germany in the, what I'll call, capitalist community. And so they could not, what you might call, put them in such despair without fear that they would reach eastward to the Soviet Union for support. I was just going to say, I once had a friend who was working in Japan and he said that the relationship between wages and productivity around the world could be understood by taking a globe and a string and measuring the string from the border of the Soviet Union to the country in question. So Japan was near Kamchatka and the eastern part of the Soviet Union, Scandinavia on the west, but that what had always happened was to avoid regime switching, people paid what I will call a risk premium against social discord for fear that it would give leverage to the Soviet power. And I wonder if that wasn't a part, even though the argument you make is a very good reason why we should emulate the experience of Germany, because it became a win-win game. The question I guess I'm leaning towards now is, where is the pressure going to come from that makes people today implement that better path, that win-win game?
You know, I couldn't agree with you more. It's absolutely true. I think I mentioned that, you know, it's the context of the Cold War. And there's absolutely no doubt that the generosity towards Germany was hugely advanced, not only by this fear of regime switch that you're mentioning, but just by trying to showcase West Germany in relation to East Germany, even out of the rest of Eastern Europe. You know, when we were young, there used to be this joke in the developing world that the best thing that can happen to you is to have a communist revolution in your neighboring country. Because that way you will then get US aid, you will get access to markets, you will get a whole lot of other benefits, you'll get technology access like South Korea, you will get, you'll even have them do land reform in your country as they did in Taiwan and Korea and Japan and so on. So yes, there's a lot to be said for that. And that does give us the problem then that since a lot of the generosity, which turns out to have then been, as you said, a win-win situation, but it was driven by a political need. There is no such political need today. I do believe that's a major problem. But I think that the only way to counter that, if you like, in the absence of that other block to which you can suddenly turn, is to have some kind of cooperation among debtors. We've talked about this before in many times in the 20th century, in the late 20th century, that the idea that since there are creditors' cartels, you really need to have debtor cartels. But I think it's come to a point now where the power imbalances are so large and they operate in such an unfortunate way, which is disastrous for everybody, for creditors and debtors, that it's necessary for debtors to cooperate and to demand together common terms. Whether that's politically possible also is another tough question. I mean, that's again something that we can talk about and strive for, but maybe it's not going to be so easy.
The specter of China and the rivalry in the geopolitics with the United States and its coalition might not rear its head in a way that produces some impetus for restructuring debt in places that are suffering.
I think that could have been the case, let's say even 4 or 5 years ago, and maybe it will again emerge. But the last few years have seen somewhat of a retreat of China. China was very aggressively ensuring its position and providing an important source of alternative liquidity, not just through its own investment and through aid, but also through the development banks, which the Exim Bank, the China Development Bank, they were pouring in many multiples of the money of all of G8 put together. And that has been very significant. Chinese Central Bank is also engaged in a bunch of exchange rate swaps, which are counter in the sense that they are providing to stressed countries, not just to the usual suspects who don't really need them so much anyway. But in the last couple of years, China has actually reduced this kind of commitment. Additional new investments have come down drastically. The Belt and Road Initiative is really being, I won't say wound up, but it's certainly being reduced significantly. New aid has also come down quite a bit to some of the particularly stressed countries, whether you look at Venezuela or some of the African countries and so on. I think I'm not quite sure what's going on. There's possibly some kind of a policy debate going on within China about the extent to which they want to have that external footprint and whether the geopolitical conditions are best for doing it now. But it is the case that developing countries that could have looked to China, first of all, as major sources for their export markets and for keeping the terms of trade somehow buoyant, and as a source of alternative liquidity, that's come down a bit, which I think is very unfortunate. I think that China could, at this point especially, play a very important role in at least providing some kind of an alternative and enabling developing countries to have a better bargaining position vis-a-vis mm-hmm. the major creditors of the advanced economies.
Well, let's talk a little bit about the conditions in the developing countries. You've mentioned the accumulation of debt in some of them historically. We've seen a very, very rapid growth in the debt in the private sector, non-financial corporations. We see what's usually referred to as a shadow banking system. And what concerns me is that many of these manifestations of the growth of debt are not explicitly designed, implemented, or even refereed by the governments. And yet the contingent fiscal capacity that they will reach toward in an acute downturn in stress, like we've accumulated the so that if the downturn begins to accelerate, they will reach across the boundaries to try to say, as they did in the great financial crisis in the United States, if you don't bail us out, we'll take you all down with us. And then we redirect that contingent fiscal capacity towards, validating the moral hazard of their excessive risk-taking, and then the health systems, the environmental transformation, and the alleviation of poverty and other things are left, in the wreckage. How are we going to get to the place where we deal with this debt and maintain a balance in terms of development and humanistic priorities unless the creditors take a very major part of the burden of loss?
Yes, so that's absolutely the point. In fact, what you're saying is not even in the future. It's happening right now. Through the pandemic, there is a very large number of developing countries that have not really increased their total spending on health and who are still paying more in debt service than they are for their domestic health systems or for a whole range of other necessary spending that you would need to recover from the pandemic and to support the populations during this crisis. So it's not even something that will happen. It is already happening. And I think this is precisely the point that right now we are in a situation where private debtors within a country can hold the rest of the society and their states to ransom by saying, as you said, you don't sort us out, we will take the whole system down. And yet developing countries as a group are unable to combine and tell international private creditors that you have to actually enable a resolution of this. You have to write off some of this debt. You have to take haircuts. And you have to enable us to actually grow our way out of this crisis rather than to just collapse further and further.
See some sentiment for doing things like delaying, suspending debt service for a period of time until the pandemic's over, but you're still, not restructuring, reducing the principal, which would alleviate the burden in the longer term.
Well, it's even worse. It's not a debt standstill where you are completely eliminating the debt service payments during this period. It's a moratorium. So you're just pushing the can down the road. And as you push it, it gets larger and larger. So I
Oh, so they're accumulating additional principal because the interest that's in arrears. They're not exactly. foregoing the interest.
Exactly.
Right. Exactly.
And so,
that's a good point.
So, in fact, the design of the moratoria was all wrong. You should not be having to pay interest at all over this period. I mean, if everything else is suspended, if economies are suspended, if lockdowns are meaning that there's no activity, why should finance keep getting paid? Yet what we've done is to say, well, you don't have to pay it this month. You can pay it 3 months from now, but you will pay the interest for this period. In addition, it will be compounded to all the interest that you have to pay. I think that's unacceptable. And it's interestingly, I don't think this is what is being asked of many of the debt deals that are being done for corporations in the advanced economies. So when I told you that there are two examples that are available, one is the historical example of Germany, but the other is the current example of how many advanced governments are treating some of their favored corporations. And they are getting credit on very beneficial terms, often without conditionalities, often in ways that allow them to keep paying out huge dividends, throwing out workers, cutting down on all kinds of other activities, maintaining their profits through the pandemic, and without having to worry about this accumulation of debt. So if the global community and if international creditors could treat the international debtors with the same generosity with which corporations in the advanced countries are being treated by their governments, then we would have a very different story.
I want to crystallize and clarify something. I've been talking with you, what you might say, about contingent logic. And each time you're emphasizing that the overwhelming crisis is already here. When I was involved last spring with some of the background deliberations on Argentina, I knew in Argentina that it was already here, but it seems it's already here in such a broad and deep scale. And essentially the officials, I mean, the IMF, I'm going to ask you what they've done. Do they practice what they preach? But they've been preaching a slightly different vision. United Nations Commission on Trade and Development, UNCTAD, has done some very interesting work, but it looks like we're already beyond a sustainable place, and yet we're like, what you may say in a presidential election year in the United States, we've been deer looking in frozen, looking into the headlights of an oncoming truck, rather than beginning to take action. And as you said, there may be, without action, just a widespread default, a kind of a wreckage, not a restructuring, that could, how do you say, deepen and lengthen the downturn that everyone would face and all of the pain and destruction that came with it. So how do you see the officials reacting now? Where do you see hope? Where do you see people who look like they're ostriches with their head in the sand?
I think most of the global community are behaving like ostriches with their head in the sand. And that's quite shocking to me. Whether it is the G20 meetings or it is, frankly, even the IMF meeting of the fall meetings, I felt that there was a real lack of awareness of the spread and severity of the crisis in most of the world. And I don't necessarily mean only the developing world. So there is a point, I think, beyond which you cannot push this. And look at the IMF. You mentioned this thing about, what does it practice what it preaches? Absolutely not. We have very welcome statements from Kristalina Georgieva. We have good statements from the IMF chief economist, Geeta Gopinath, about the need for fiscal policy, about the need to spend more in this crisis, and particularly on health systems and on basic needs for the people and so on. Yet what does the IMF do when it has to actually confront countries that go to it for assistance? What is it doing in Ecuador? What is it doing in Argentina? What has it done in Pakistan? What is it doing in a range of other countries that have been forced to go in the pandemic with cap in hand because of things that were absolutely outside their control. It is asking once again for austerity. It's asking for public sector cuts, for wage freezes, for employment declines, for the usual things. So the IMF, I don't know if you want to call it a forked tongue or whether there's a real disconnect between the operational staff and the so-called policy that happens at the meta level, the policy discussions at the meta level. But in practice, the IMF is behaving just as it always did, which is frankly disastrous. But it's also that the rest of the major sort of conglomerations of the international power structure, if you like, don't seem to recognize the urgent need for debt restructuring. And they keep thinking you can isolate a few guys and, as you said, make an example of them, tell the others they have to toe the line, keep forcing dribs and drabs of the debt servicing out, maybe reschedule a little bit rather than restructure, and keep extracting as much as you can. This is not going to be, I think, beyond a point, I cannot see this being politically feasible, because you will be unleashing such terrible economic devastation and such completely socially unworkable societies because of the deep increase in inequality that these are not governments that will be in a position to pay anyway. I think the debtors who are the creditors who are taking this position, whether they are the bondholders or the others, they are really short-sighted. They are really simply not seeing what they are letting themselves in for. And I think that it's not even very far into the future. I think we are possibly going to see this in the coming year.
Yeah. How are you seeing private actors? I'm not, you know, when I was looking at the Argentine situation, I could see what you might say, the echoes of the resentment that emerged during the great financial crisis. Remember at the time, they referred, I think it was Matt Taibbi referred to Goldman Sachs and company as the vampire squid. Articles started to be written about BlackRock as the new vampire squid. And the people in the private sector were quite aware of how politically powerful and resented they had been in the last go-round. And they have, how do I say, have to tread a little bit more lightly in light of that history in the context of the pandemic. But I haven't seen bold leadership coming from the private sector unless I've missed things. And I'm curious what you're seeing. Are you seeing people just remaining silent? Are you seeing people being strident and tough in these negotiations in a kind of mindless way, and meaning not consistent with the depth and scale of overhang? So where is the private sector? I'm really getting at, like, when you talk about IMF, they preach one thing, but they don't seem to invoke it. What's the power structure behind the curtain acting like, and what coherence do they think it has to press so hard against proactive debt restructuring?
I think this is one of those situations where what Marx called the anarchy of capitalism, or what today's economists would call incentive incompatibility, get really obvious. The problem with a large part of this private debt market is the possibility of rogue creditors holding out and destroying it for everyone else. Of course, the Argentine experience shows that very, very clearly, that you can, because so many of these debt contracts are based in either London, the city of London, or New York, and it's the laws of that land that prevail, unfortunately still, it's possible for a few rogue creditors to hold out and completely mess the system up for everybody else. Now, once that's the case, even the, you know, the more rational people, I forget whether they're good or bad or moral or ethical or not, but the more rational people who realize that this is unsustainable and that we need some kind of a debt workout, some kind of restructuring and so on, they can't really afford to come out and say it because the structure of that whole negotiation is different. And if you have a few rogues, then the incentives are all against you. it's not in your interest anymore to want to have a reasonable settlement. And I think that's a real problem. I think this is now something which is systemic, and we won't be able to resolve until we change the nature of sovereign debt restructuring and create a proper settlement mechanism. Because there will always be this disincentive to achieve a rational thing as long as there are some who will hold out. And there will always be the rogues who hold out.
It's interesting when you talk about that. It brings echoes back of the experience I had. I grew up in Detroit, Michigan, and we had the bankruptcy of the city of Detroit. And at the time, people were using the analogy to a corporate bankruptcy. But what they did was they didn't go raise taxes on wealthy and powerful people or businesses. They cut the benefits of retirees, largely women who had worked 40 years in the municipal government of the city, cut their health care, cut their pensions down from, say, $18,000 to $12,000. And it was a very odd feeling, which was, yes, things were unsustainable, but in the trenches, who was going to bear the burden of the adjustment? And it feels now like, and I think you made a very good point in that last passage. This isn't about charity or morality or whatever at some level. It's about seeing the dynamic, inevitable mathematical logic of that if you don't restructure and stabilize and engender growth, you're going to lose more of your principal the day after tomorrow than if you got ahead of the curve. So they're shooting themselves in the foot by playing these tough games, not just what you might call the victims on the other side.
Yes, exactly. But unfortunately, even if there are, let's say, 70% of the creditors who see this, the very fact that there are 30% or 20% or 10% or even two creditors who say nothing doing is enough to spoil the game. Because we don't have an established legal mechanism, and we have to do that. It's so urgent that we need an international mechanism, not one that is dependent on whatever rules were worked out in the City of London contracts or in Wall Street contracts. I think that's one of the essential messages that this, the whole treatment of debt during this period has to bring home to us.
How would I say? You raise a very interesting question. And again, I talk about the echoes of the great financial crisis. I remember talking with my friend and former teacher, longtime friend Joe Stiglitz, at the onset of the 2008 crisis. I was down working as an alumni of the Senate Banking Committee, helping out on the TARP legislation and other things. And I didn't like what I was seeing. And Joe didn't either. And Joe talked to me about how the design of TARP, which, as he said, the polluters got paid, was going to create a deterioration in confidence. But he said, the confidence in the financial sector will go down, and then we'll get back to a solid and a sane financial system. But in fact, whether it's the Tea Party or on the right or Occupy on the left, what we experienced was a loss of faith in governance and expertise that permeated far more than just the financial sector. And this is a long-winded prelude, but Jayadi, I'm curious now, because it does seem to me like you're right, that a sovereign debt restructuring mechanism of large scale, administering things in a very different way than has been unfolding in this last few months, is necessary, but that also seems to require having a faith in expertise and public sector that in many ways surprised Joe Stiglitz how much that deteriorated rather than just loss of confidence and respect in the private sector. Are we at a place where people are ready to entrust these big decisions to the public sector again?
This is such a...
Maybe necessity is the mother of invention here.
You know, this is such a tough question because I think, you know, everywhere in the world, politics has gone very differently from what many of us would think as political economists, right? I mean, as you said, the global financial crisis should have engineered much greater social distrust in private finance rather than in the public sector. The pandemic should have engendered much greater respect for health systems and on the significance of investing in care. These things don't seem to happen somehow. And instead, we get the opposite kinds of responses. And we get the opposite things where you really get people pushing for things that are fundamentally against their own interests. You get people supporting, a Trumpian version of economics in the United States, which would be actively against their own interests. You get people in India supporting a government that is decimating the economy and destroying livelihoods because they get persuaded by other aspects or the media is, I would say the mainstream media is very complicit in this as well, and social media are able to either divert their attention or direct it towards others, migrants or minorities or some other category whom they can blame for their troubles. I don't think this can continue indefinitely. I don't believe that this ability to mislead and manipulate people at large against their fundamental material interests is something that can be prolonged beyond a point. So it's not necessarily that it will express itself in the old ways. I think we don't always see exactly where the change is coming from. It often comes from very unexpected directions and sources. I'm told that, the books I read about the New Deal and so on, three months before FDR was elected, nobody anticipated that there would be those kinds of sweeping changes that he brought about. So I think these changes occur in different ways, but I cannot see us not having these changes because this is otherwise a system which is really on the verge of collapse. And it's not just the sovereign debt system which is on the verge of collapse, which it definitely is. It's not just the global debt system which would be on the verge of collapse. It would be a whole range of other aspects of the world as we know it, if you like, broader global capitalism, which would simply no longer be able to function. So I think ways will be found. I don't think we will get to that point of falling over the cliff, that solutions will emerge because they have to emerge to keep the thing going. Now, the big issue I see, though, is that of the power imbalances, which in the past have certainly ensured that those who were responsible for the crisis were the ones who also ended up benefiting the most from it. Finance, for example, in the global financial crisis. But that power imbalance, I think that one is a more complicated issue, and we have to really think about what kind of politics will work towards sufficiently reducing that power imbalance. You know, you made a very interesting point about Detroit and how the municipal bankruptcy was then, eventually the costs of that were put on the backs of ordinary workers and all the essential workers, as we would call them today, who kept the city going. But it's not just in periods of crisis. You look at one of the biggest beneficiaries of this pandemic, Amazon. Okay, profits have doubled, the wealth of Jeff Bezos has doubled and all of that kind of thing. And they are denying their workers a whole range of extra leave and extra medical protection. And yet there is absolutely no reason for them to do so. They are, as a company, one of the biggest beneficiaries. And they're certainly not in any kind of financial difficulty. So it's really a question of the power imbalances that enable these kinds of exploitation and growing inequality to get perpetuated. And that change in the power imbalance will not happen without counter pressure. So it can't just be, I think we were building up to the counter pressure, whether you call it Occupy or there was a range of protests in India. There are big protests by the farmers in India today, 2 million of them.
Well, I think the counter pressure is It's interesting now because, for instance, the gentleman that made the movie, Joel Bacon, called The Corporation, mm-hmm. has been, how would I say, warning us that people who have gone from what I'll call the Milton Friedman shareholder value is the only thing that matters to stakeholder value, mm-hmm. he's seeing that as a false consciousness, an attempt to act like you're doing good while you're doing well, but again, perhaps not practicing as you preach. On the other hand, I talk to many people who work in the private sector. You can really see what you might call exploded in terms of our consciousness, and what's unmasked is sufficient evidence that the system we were running does need drastic restructuring and repair. And they don't sit as righteously in the C-suites of their corporations any longer, talking as though Milton Friedman's famous article, which I saw Martin Wolf just underscored its failings in the Financial Times last week. But they don't how do I say, pontificate on those grounds any longer. So at some level, you can feel like what you might call the fabric of that false consciousness is being strained, but we're not quite breaking into new territory.
Well, you know, I think the seeds of change are there, or the winds of change are there. Consider, for example, the big antitrust legislations that are happening now today in the United States and in Europe. I mean, there have been people talking about the massive control, the oligopolistic power, the huge concentration exercised by these digital companies for a decade at least. But it hasn't really translated into real action. And now, in the space of a few months, we have a major action against Google, a major action against Amazon. In the European Union, you have actions against, and a major action against Facebook. In the European Union, you have similar actions. And in the EU, they are saying, it's not just lawsuits, we're going to actually change the regulations. I think it's very clear to me, the digital companies, within a few years, they will be broken up. Their power will be curtailed. We will see some of the changes that follow on the Sherman Act kinds of activities in terms of just the digital. That's not going to be enough to transform everything, but it is an indication of a change in the way things are. And I think we're going to see more and more of that in different areas, because as it becomes evident that you've reached a point where you've really created these hydra-headed monsters who are going to become absolutely impossible to control unless you do something now, then ultimately governments will respond because societies will force them to.
What role does the unsustainable carbon-burning energy system play in, as I use the phrase, necessity is the mother of invention, in moving us towards some different institutional and more collective structure? Because people can see, particularly in these daunting times, that the energy systems must be profoundly changed. And some have talked about a Green New Deal is the way in which we sustain global aggregate demand in a macroeconomic sense while doing things with the money that matter to our survival. But others are still very skeptical, just as we're talking about the debt renegotiation, of the power of the fossil fuel industry in blocking change.
You know, once again, I think there's also a very strong north-south divide here. Because in the north, there is much more discussion of a Green New Deal. There's much more awareness. There's much more government willingness to regulate. Certainly, I think the Biden government will do so. The European Union will also do so. Japan will do so. But in the developing world, the pandemic has actually set back the cause of climate alleviation very drastically. Governments are so desperate to restart their economies any which way that they are deregulating the environment. They're encouraging and incentivizing fossil fuel industries. They are providing special subsidies to more polluting and carbon-emitting activities. And they are aided in this, once again, by international debt markets that are happy to provide the loans to do that. So in the developing world, we're actually seeing a worsening of the conditions that would enable climate mitigation and adaptation, which it's unbelievable, but true. You know, we went through a brief period of saying, wow, the pandemic has reduced all this stuff because of lockdowns. The minute the lockdowns are lifted, in India, they've been lifted even when the rate of infection is going up exponentially. But once the lockdowns are lifted, governments are desperate to do anything. And they're actually going back on many of the pledges. And they're further deregulating carbon-emitting industries.
In the scheme of things, who would you point our listeners to pay close attention to, or writings, books, papers about the way forward that you would like to see? Obviously, your own writing, Project Syndicate, and many other places is a very good example. And that's why I was inspired to speak with you again today. But I'm curious, who in the world of policy or private sector or whatever, who's getting out in front of this in a way that you would put a light on for all of us to observe?
You know, among the international institutions, I would say UNCTAD, you mentioned, right? The UN Conference on Trade and Development. They have been producing some excellent reports, the trade and development reports, which have actually shone a very detailed light on new possibilities. Yes. Whether it's the Green New Deal, yeah, whether it is dealing with sovereign debt, whether it is controlling finance, I think they have really been at the forefront of progressive thinking globally on a lot of these matters. And I would very strongly recommend their work.
Richard Kozol and Ursula Costantini they were on with me for an episode, and Stephanie Blankenberg was on for another episode. And I just underscore that for our listeners, because they were, in one case, Stephanie was telling me about the preparation of the vision in the report, and the other two were telling me about the report in itself. But I think that's a very good suggestion. That's one that I would put it near the top of the perspective. I'll have to say, a brother and sister team, the famous writer Naomi Klein,
mm-hmm, yes,
and her older brother Seth, who's just written a book about the analogy for climate striving in Canada to the war preparation for World War II. And how habits have to change and institutions have to change, and things must be done in a very different way than what you might call individual freedom and market behavior dictating where we go. And Seth's book that's just come out is extraordinary.
Oh, that sounds very interesting. Yes, Naomi Klein, you're absolutely right, but I didn't know about Seth Klein, and I will now go and look for the book.
I'll help you find it. But it's just, because he talks as though what we know about climate science is the challenge. And he then focuses his writing on what is the means to meet that challenge and preserve life on Earth. And I told him in that conversation that I want to have somebody write a book about what it meant to be the parents of those two brilliant writers, brother and sister, because they sure produced an excellent pair. Any rate, so in your last, just closing thoughts here, what kind of work, you're a member of the INET Commission on Global Economic Transformation. What kind of work should you and I be doing together with the 18 or I think it's now 20 other people and the staff over the coming year as we write our reports?
I think really that, you know, it has to be on several levels, because there are some what I would call low-hanging fruit that are really available and begging to be plucked in terms of dealing with the crisis and putting forward an alternative route. One of them is international tax cooperation. And I and Joe Stiglitz are among the members of another commission, the International Commission on the Reform of International Corporate Taxation. And we've been arguing that you have to have a unitary system of taxation for multinationals at a basic global rate, say 25% or so. That would actually get around all the difficulties of base erosion and profit shifting, where multinationals can just avoid tax by claiming that all their profits come from Ireland or the Netherlands or Delaware or somewhere. And that we should have a global asset registry so that very, very wealthy people, high net worth individuals, can't just move their wealth around to escape even the most minimal wealth taxation. This would actually raise huge amounts of money. It's a win-win situation for citizens and governments, and it's only stopped by the lobbying power of the very rich and the multinationals. So that's a solution just waiting there. There's an obvious solution in terms of SDRs that the IMF should be issuing that will provide immediate liquidity for a large range of countries. There are issues about sovereign debt. So there are many issues with the international architecture that need work. And I do believe, since the US government is so important in all of these things, I do believe the conditions for enabling some of these are now much improved compared to the last 4 years. But then there are also so many things to be done at the national level. So I believe this commission can do a lot in terms of providing possibilities for countries at different stages of development and facing different constraints. A lot of the discussion of even global warming and climate change takes place, let's face it, in a very northern context, where a certain minimum level of material existence has been achieved for everyone. In large parts of the developing world, people are still, you know, they don't have basic housing. They do not have access to adequate nutrition. They don't have water. They don't have electricity. Half of the rural households in India still don't have electricity. So there's so many things that have to be done. And you have to therefore look at the issues around the environment differently. So I think we need to bring those perspectives in and talk about how we can think of international packages that can translate into enabling particular kinds of policy advances within particular country contexts. And I think this commission is uniquely placed to do that because it's a bunch of very impressive, brilliant people. I'm so proud to be among them. And they have very varied perspectives and very varied backgrounds. So I think it really is an excellent place that could do these things.
I think there's so much work to do, and it just feels good to listen to you and your passion, your intensity, feeling like there's another shoulder at the wheel along with this Stiglitz and Spence-led commission. And as I was listening to you today, I don't know if it was me or whatever, but a song by David Bowie came into my mind. And the song is called Lady Grinning Soul. It was written about a woman named Claudia Lanier, who used to be one of the Ikettes with Ike and Tina, and then became a solo artist. And as I listened to you, your enthusiasm, your passion, your unrelenting drive is something I was glowing, so I think it was my soul that was grinning. But I also saw the intensity of Nina Simone and the power and the the courage that she exhibited. And the reason I wanted to bring this all out at this juncture is that I know that you've just left India and come to the United States. And that I'm sure that in some ways that was very painful because of the pressures that the Modi government is put on outspoken and courageous intellectuals. But I want to tell you how much I admire that courage. And while it may not feel good to pick up and leave, you should be proud when you look in the mirror that you how they say, inspired a dreadful action because it showed you were on the right track. So thank you for that.
Wow, Rob. I don't know if I deserve that, but it really is very, very important for me that you feel that. Thank you.
Well, let's adjourn. We'll come back for another episode here and talk about the medical condition, intellectual property rights, COVID vaccination, and how that relates to our global political economy. And so join me, folks, for what will be part three of our 2020 discussions, but part two here in the fourth quarter. But thank you for this very, very powerful exploration of sovereign debt and the kind of institutional adjustments that we all must rise and enact in order to get back on track and regain confidence in governance, in society, and for the well-being of our children. Thank you very much. And check out more from the Institute for New Economic Thinking at ineteconomics.org.
And I'll tell it and speak it and think it and breathe it. And reflect from the mountains so all souls can see it. And I'll stand on the ocean until I start sinking. But I'll know my song well before I start singing.